Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Here is the news of the world reported by NBC correspondents at home and abroad. We hear this morning from Washington, Stockholm, Australia, London, and Cairo. And first to our own capital with Richard Harkness of the Philadelphia Inquirer speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
Here in Washington this morning, the government is moving closer to a universal draft law to win the war. A law drafting labor, materials, and industry to whip the axis. A law giving President Roosevelt unprecedented power. Power unprecedented even in time of war, to marshal every ounce of the nation's strength for the war effort. The measure was introduced in the Senate yesterday. The bill went into the legislative hopper under the sponsorship of Senator Lister Hill, the bald-headed, energetic young Democrat from Alabama. Last week, the administration dropped its first hint that a universal service law probably would be necessary. But no one on Capitol Hill expected it to come quite so soon. The measure has the full backing of the American Legion. For out in Kansas City, where the organization is holding its first wartime convention, the big veterans group passed a resolution calling for conscription of both labor and capital without delay. Even though it was unexpected, Senator Hill's measure to draft labor didn't create much excitement. The Senate was too busy debating the president's price control bill. The administration won the first round in this anti-inflation fight, with farm bloc members losing out in their attempt to have the Senate Agriculture Committee take jurisdiction over an amendment, an anti-administration amendment which would have had the effect of putting a floor under farm prices at 110% of parity. The fact that the administration won the first test of strength on the price control bill made it appear likely, made it appear even certain this morning that the Senate will pass the bill tomorrow, and the House will begin consideration of a similar measure today. So it looks as if Mr. Roosevelt will get the bill and get the price control bill he wants by his October 1st deadline. But even with price control, food will be increasingly hard to get. For Agriculture Department sources reveal, they tell us this morning that we face rationing soon on dairy products. Rationing may come in 2 months, they say, because of rapidly decreasing production of milk. And finally, our first ersatz food product of the war will soon make its appearance on our breakfast tables. It will be sausage, or at least we'll call it sausage. In fact, it will be part sausage and part soya bean. And that's all from Washington.
Well, now across the Atlantic to the European continent. From Stockholm, Sweden, close to the world's greatest battlefront, we hear the report of David Anderson. We try once again now. From Stockholm, Sweden, we're trying to contact David Anderson. Go ahead, Stockholm.
In point.
Go ahead, Stockholm.
On the basis of statements by military spokesman on Wilhelmstrasse, all of the German reports into this capital predicted the early fall of Stalingrad. Some said a week, some said 24 hours. Others restricted their comments to such ambiguous statements as the fate of Stalingrad is sealed. But a change occurred. The Russians didn't collapse according to the German schedule. They fought on when it seemed that further resistance was hopeless. Germany attributed this renewed Russian resistance to Stalin's order to make Stalingrad a Russian Verdun. Similarly, German predictions as to the fall of the city changed. No longer did they limit themselves to a specific date. They now began the line, Stalingrad will fall soon, or better yet, the date of the fall of Stalingrad is of secondary importance. Our main effort now is to spare as much German bloodshed as possible. Yesterday, the German newspaper Frankfurter Zeitung wrote this: the delay in the capture of Stalingrad is due to Stalin's brutal methods. This leads me to the second point, German losses. You will recall Goebbels' statement to the effect that German losses on the Stalingrad front were surprisingly small. but a German propaganda soldier had the unmitigated gall to contradict this official point of view by saying that the German regiments no longer had the same strength. In fact, he said that they had melted away. Well, the official circles were placed in a rather embarrassing situation. Here they were met with a direct contradiction to what they had said, and by a propaganda soldier on the Stalingrad front. In other words, by a man who knew what he was talking about. This would never do, so the military spokesman on Wilhelmstrasse came out in the afternoon with this statement. Don't take this report too seriously. Naturally, we have not been without our losses, but these have been relatively light. So much then for losses. What of the advance of the German forces around Stalingrad? The German high command would have us believe that the attacking forces are making steady progress. The extent of the progress is not mentioned. But here is what one German report will appear in this afternoon's Stockholm newspaper has to say. The German advances in the Stalingrad sector are insignificant. Contradictions and more contradictions. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
We take you now halfway around the world to one of NBC's staff correspondents in Australia.
This is Sidney Albright speaking from Australia. There has been no change in the land fighting in the Owen Stanley range, but it was revealed today that the Japanese have succeeded in hauling artillery over the mountains to their forward positions, and it is therefore expected that Jap pressure will soon be renewed. One correspondent states that these guns include long-range .92 caliber machine guns and a mountain gun of the 75-millimeter type. During the 11 days lull in the land fighting, the Japanese have widened their supply tracks, although they have been under constant strafing from our aircraft. It is reliably reported that yesterday, a wire rope bridge over the Kumusi River below Kokoda was successfully destroyed. This bridge had been destroyed once before when the Australian forces retired from the area, but it was subsequently restored by the Japanese. The Daily Mirror correspondent reports that a small Australian patrol, which had been assigned to ferret out enemy gun positions in the Owen Stanley range, located one emplacement on a high rocky ledge. Scouts who moved forward found that the position was manned by an artillery officer and six men. Crawling through undergrowth to within range, an Australian officer sniped the Japanese officer, who was watching the forward position through binoculars. As he fell dead, other Australians opened fire, killing many of the gun crew. The firing was heard by a large force of Japanese who were approaching, and they immediately broke into action. Our patrol took cover in the jungle and escaped without loss. In the first large-scale New Guinea raid for some weeks, the Japanese sent 37 aircraft, including 27 bombers, against an area northwest of Port Moresby. The bombs dropped harmlessly in the bush 32 miles from Moresby, and no damage or casualties were caused. Two officers who recently returned from Moresby declared today that when a survey was made of the Owen Stanley area after the war, it would be found that Japanese aerial losses were far more severe than Allied intelligence reports had indicated. Many heroes which escaped from the dogfights around Moresby are reported to have crashed in trying to gain altitude to cross the range. One officer said, "Our computation of enemy losses has been conservative to the point of severity." Meanwhile, the Mikado's air force is remarkably inactive. There was only one interception attack by Zulus last week. There have been only three since the start of the month, despite the fact that our planes have been particularly busy during the same period. It was officially announced today by headquarters that another Australian coastal vessel was attacked by a Japanese submarine. But the vessel, although damaged, was towed to port and is now being reconditioned. No casualties were reported as a result of the attack. This is Sidney Albright speaking from Australia.
Now it's time for the latest news from the British capital, where John McVane is waiting to report. Go ahead, London.
Good morning. This is London. The tiny state of Luxembourg is fighting back against her huge neighbor, enemy, Germany. Jean Vercel, a Luxembourger who's just escaped to London, asserted today that Luxembourg patriots have prepared measures to be taken at the moment of Germany's defeat. He said the underground movement sprang into life the day the Nazis marched into his country. A census by the Luxembourg Patriotic League, he said, revealed 97% of the population voting against Germany. Since the Dieppe raid, the British have had the feeling that they were waiting in the wings of the war stage. Except for insignificant air raids around the coast, there haven't been any attacks on Britain itself. British forces haven't been doing anything to inspire the home front. Most people feel that their leaders are preparing something, that much is going on underneath the surface. But the waiting is a difficult time when rumors get free play and men and women go about their own daily work with the hope that tomorrow may call for some great effort or some magnificent deed. The London Times today says that the British are waiting on events. The paper says that someday the British will learn how rich in drama were the delays which now so sorely irk the spirit. And the Times adds, that drama will move against the background of our enduring patience and gain grandeur from it. General Acre, commander of American Army bombers over here, has told a British journalist that there are enough aerodromes in the British Isles now built and building to accommodate all the Allied air forces needed for the destruction of Germany. General Acre came out strongly on the side of those experts who believe that Germany can be destroyed from the air. This question has been argued back and forth for 3 years in Britain. About the only thing a cautious observer can say is that it's going to be a very, very difficult job that will take a long time. If giant forces could operate every night and day, most of the big German industrial centers could probably be wrecked in a matter of months. But really huge forces aren't yet available. Weather often prevents flying for several days in a row, and defenses are very strong. As things stand now, by the time Allied bombing attacks began to cripple the German war machine, Germany might have finished off Russia and be ready to throw her army into an invasion of Britain. One British expert today takes an almost directly opposite line. He thinks that only close cooperation between Army and Air Force will win the war. And he thinks Army generals ought to take an Army-Air Force cooperation course and then fly in one or two operational flights. And now, for news of the war in Egypt, we will go ahead to Cairo.
This is Grant Farr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. Not long ago, I wrote that there was a quiet day on the Alamein front. A military censor told me I couldn't say that because there were men being killed up there every day. Whether the communique said nothing to report from our land forces or talked about patrol activity. While in warfare, as in most other things, all terms are relative. A quiet day means quiet in comparison. But when I heard today that yesterday's land operations were confined to artillery exchanges, I did remember that the war doesn't just stop because there's no real battle going on. If a man spends one moment too long out of his footprint, he may catch a bomb fragment or a piece of shrapnel in his body. If he walks about once too often, a sniper's bullet may administer the silent, seemingly sourceless sort of death stroke that is so much more terrible than a bursting shell. Last night I heard about sniping from a man who spends his days picking off rash Germans. As he talked, I could visualize the rough, ridge-cut, scrub-dotted sand at Alamein and the blowing, dusty territory near the White Ridge. Into this yellow no-man's land crawl snipers, covered in sacking, dragging rifles, and camouflage sheets. The problems of concealment, you see, are very much like those in snow-covered terrain. A desert sniper may closely resemble the ski troops and special winter units of the Russians, except that their costumes are white to blend with the snow, and his is yellow to blend with the sand. A sniper is a picked, specially trained marksman. He is chosen for ability to shoot, intelligence, and resourcefulness. For once he leaves his unit, he is entirely on his own. He uses an ordinary rifle fitted with a telescopic sight and spots his victims with strong binoculars. Sniping sounds like a mean, cruel job with all the odds in one's own favor, but my sniper friend knows better. The other day, a strong desert wind blew away his camouflage sheet, and the Germans spotted him. They let go with mortars which laid shells within a few feet of his prostrate body. There's no reason at all why I'm here alive now, he said. Those mortars should have hit me. They just didn't, that's all. I now return you to New York.
You've been listening to the news of the world as reported by NBC correspondents at home and abroad. This is the National Broadcasting Company. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the NBC newsroom in New York, ready to call in our correspondents at home and abroad with the news of the world. For the latest report from the Russian battlefront,
We take you now to Moscow.
This is Robert Magidoff speaking from Moscow. Unable to advance further along the streets of Stalingrad they had seized, the Germans have driven spearheads into new streets and captured several of them. The defenders, in the meantime, have launched counterattacks in other sectors of the city and have regained some ground. The fiercest fighting is for street crossings, as each crossing is a key to three or four city blocks. Here, the Russians have built barricades as massive as the sandbanks of the Volga. Indeed, a number of these barricades consist of sand piled up in bags. These are barriers which even German anti-tank shells cannot pierce. In the storm of steel and lead sweeping the streets of Stalingrad, both sides are fighting desperately, not only for buildings. Every ruined wall, a newspaper stand, switch booth, overturned automobile, or wrecked tank is being fought for desperately. The defenders are making such a stand that their resistance is broken only after the Luftwaffe comes to the aid of the charging tanks and tommy gunners. Taking full advantage of their overwhelming superiority in the air, the Germans are making as many as 2,000 individual plane flights daily, usually concentrating them on narrow sectors. While the latest reports of the street fighting inside Stalingrad favor the Germans, the Red Army seems to have captured initiative on the southwestern and northwestern approaches to the city and is pushing the enemy back slowly but surely. These counterattacks are supported by Russian artillery, which has never yet failed the Red Army in its valiant stand against the invader. The Germans received an especially severe setback at one point where 21 Soviet batteries reinforced by anti-aircraft guns dropped a lasso of deadly fire on a large concentration of enemy tanks and motorized infantry. These hundreds of tanks and thousands of infantry failed to participate in the battles that followed, with the result that the Red Army advanced in this sector. A new touch has been added to the battle at Mozdok in the Caucasus, a battle that's almost unreal in its swift changes of fortune and its weird, fantastic picturesqueness. Here, the German tanks are fighting literally in the cloud, far above the roaring river Terek. Yesterday, the Russian defenders of a vital hill were surprised as 120 German tanks, their motors muffled, suddenly plunged at them from behind a mist of clouds. The Russians, however, quickly recovered and sent the Panzer on the run after destroying 26 of the attacking German tanks. Goodbye from Moscow.
This is New York again. Now for the news from the British capital, we take you to John McVane in London.
This is London. British troops yesterday were approaching the outskirts of Antananarivo, the capital of Madagascar. They may be in the city by now. An official statement today from East African Army headquarters says the advance was achieved in the face of stiffening Vichy resistance. French troops were supported by artillery. British naval experts are commenting on the German radio description of the Luftwaffe attacks on the Allied convoy for Russia last week. The radio description put out from Berlin last night speaks of the Luftwaffe's painful sacrifices and talks of an escort of 30 warships putting up a wall of fire. A general deduction here is that the convoy wasn't a disaster, as the Germans first claimed, but a hard-won Allied victory. At 50, most men are too old to undergo the strain of flying on regular bombing raids. Air battle is a young man's warfare. You may remember the American Army Air Corps joke about the notice in the mess, stating that lieutenant colonels under 20 wouldn't be served liquor unless accompanied by their parents. But a 50-year-old British flyer, Squadron Leader Fielding Johnson, has just been awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. He's flown in many daring raids, including the 1,000 bomber attacks on Cologne, the Ruhr, and Bremen. The officer flew in the last war and won a decoration for gallantry. He entered the RAF in this war as a ground officer. Then he succeeded in convincing the authorities that he was fit to fly. Now he commands a bomber station. American Army chaplains in Britain are beginning a series of meetings today at U.S. Army headquarters. General Dahlquist, Deputy Chief of Staff, is attending the conferences. The chaplains are discussing the problem of American troops' marriages in Britain, the work of the Red Cross, and other similar subjects. The Germans have been issuing indignant denials about the Allied government's report on executions in the occupied territories. The denials aren't impressive, especially since the Germans themselves have announced enough executions and killings to make it apparent that someday they'll have to pay heavy retribution. The diplomatic correspondent of the London Times today surveys what the Axis has been doing among the Slovene people. Slovene railroad lines link Italy and the Romanian oil fields and carry supplies for Rommel's forces. The Germans themselves have announced that 16 Slovene villages have been wiped out, nearly 1,500 hostages shot, and 165,000 Slovenes deported to Germany in the Eastern Territories. The Italians have wiped out 42 villages near the railroads and taken 70,000 Slovenes to Italy. The Italians have shot several thousand as hostages or in raids. And the local Italian commander has suspended all local passenger trains in this Balkan area. I return you now to New York.
On the United Nations battlefront in the Southwest Pacific, another NBC reporter is standing by. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Sidney Albright speaking from Australia. In their greatest and most extensive blitz on the Jap supply lines in New Guinea, Allied air forces yesterday swept up and down the vital track with fighter planes raiding at least 6 points. Buna, Yeda, Kokoda, Manari, Ifogu, and Naoro. Fuel and ammunition dumps, launches, and barges were left in flames. Over 34,000 rounds were fired by the low-flying planes. And there is little doubt that these attacks, which have been pressed day after day for more than a week, are slowing up the drive on the frontline areas of the Owen Stanley Range by affecting the Japanese supply situation. In other sweeping raids, flying fortresses scored two direct hits on a large supply ship at Raval, and Catalina's blasted the air drum at Buka in the Solomons with the aid of flare lights. There was no attempt by the enemy to intercept the Allied planes making these bitter and sustained attacks, and all our planes returned safely. While the communique made no mention of the Owen Stanley front, it is reliably reported that patrol activity continues, but that no major developments had occurred in the last 24 hours. A grim warning of Japan's intentions concerning Australia has been revealed by the capture of a large number of banknotes printed by the Japanese government, which were obviously intended for use in Australia or New Zealand. The banknotes, which are in denominations of 1 pound, 10 shillings, 1 shilling, and a half shilling, were today shown to war correspondents, together with a proclamation in English issued by the Japanese Navy demanding the allegiance of natives in the Bismarck Archipelago. On the face of the notes are the words Japanese government in bold black lettering, and at the right-hand side of each is an island scene. An army spokesman said that the notes were evidence that the Japanese intended, if possible, to capture Australia. Large numbers of these notes, scrapped in packs, were captured by Allied forces during recent operations, and it is reported that they are already in use in some of the island areas. Exhibiting the proclamation, the spokesman said that it was circulated by the Japanese among the educated section of island natives who were expected to spread the story to other natives unable to read or speak English. The proclamation contains several misspelled words. It reads, and I now quote, "We guarantee your life and property. Nippon has declared war against United States of America and England and is going to the glorious war with them to keep the independence and honor of the yellow race. Already, Navy of Nippon is winning a victory everywhere and occupied all Bismarck Archipelago. Therefore, you don't belong to the sovereignty of England, but to the sovereignty of Nippon. See your circumstances in past time. There is nothing but oppression and squeeze of the white race. Follow us, and happiness and wealth will be given. Signed, Navy of Japan." This is Sidney Albright speaking from Australia.
Now for the news from our own national capital. As reported by Richard Harkness of the Philadelphia Inquirer, we take you to Washington. The big news here in Washington this morning is that the Japanese may be tightening their grip on the Aleutian Islands, that they may be launching a new offensive in the Northwest Pacific. The report comes from the Tokyo radio, so we should take it with a liberal coating of salt. But here's what the Japanese claim. They claim that their navy attacked the Aleutian island of Atka on August 31st. They say that in the battle, one of our big battle cruisers, a 9,000-ton American cruiser of the Northampton class, was severely damaged by Japanese submarines. If the Japanese announcement is true, it's also important. For Atka is midway between Dutch Harbor, our big base up there, and Kiska, one of the first islands the Japanese captured. If the Japanese are telling the truth, and I might add that on past performances, they probably are not. They are obviously trying to cut off Kiska from Dutch Harbor. There's no confirmation of the Japanese claims here in Washington. And without any details, military observers can only speculate. At first blush, they believe that if the Japanese are reopening activities in Alaska, they're trying to divert American naval units from the Solomon Islands. For the Japanese are reeling under the blows of our fast-growing offensive power in that section of the Pacific. The Navy Department's latest communique on the Solomons was released late yesterday. A dramatic announcement of how American warplanes damaged another Japanese cruiser off the Solomon. Dive bombers did this job. Their successful attack brought to 23 the number of enemy ships sunk or damaged in that area in the last 6 weeks. But we have our losses too. Two of our merchant ships, two freighters carrying supplies to Malta, went down in the Mediterranean early last month after a harrowing 4-day battle with Axis submarines and planes and surface craft. So it becomes apparent, more and more apparent, that we must establish superiority in the sea and in the air before the United Nations can launch their all-out second front attack on the Japanese in the Orient and against Hitler in Europe and Africa. But we have assurance this morning that the Navy will soon be ready for the task. The Navy will soon be ready to take the offensive with a superior force in any theater of war it chooses. For the Navy Department, cooperating with Representative Carl Vinson of the House Naval Affairs Committee, says our victories in the Solomons and the United Nations raid on Dieppe are merely forecasts of the shape of things to come. But Mr. Roosevelt has trouble on his hands right here at home this morning. For up on Washington's Capitol Hill, the farm bloc has taken over the president's anti-inflation bill. And if indications mean anything, the farm boys have the votes to remove the last vestige of farm price control from Mr. Roosevelt's measure. The amendment the farm bloc is supporting would force the administration to revise the formula for parity to include farm labor costs. Now, the president has warned that this would wreck the whole price control program, that it would jump parity to 112% and spiral living costs upward. But the farm bloc senators are in the saddle and are ready to ride roughshod over the White House if they can. The farm bloc was pressing for a vote on the Senate floor late yesterday afternoon, but Majority Leader Barkley, apparently seeing the president was whipped, quickly adjourned the Senate and stalled the roll call until today. Barkley's strategy was obvious. He wanted time to see if he couldn't change some votes overnight. And Republican members of the House served notice on Mr. Roosevelt this morning that while they give him their wholehearted support in winning the war, they're also out to win more House seats in the congressional elections this November. For the Republicans demand that Mr. Roosevelt fully and immediately utilize the most capable and efficient military and civilian leadership in the country to win the war. The Republicans' intimation is clear. They believe Mr. Roosevelt hasn't chosen the best war leaders possible, and they intend to carry that issue to the country. And that's all from Washington.
During the past quarter hour, you have heard the news of the world, reported by Robert Magadoff in Moscow, John McVane in London, Sidney Albright in Australia, and Richard Harkness in Washington. Keep tuned to this station for the latest news. This is the National Broadcasting Company.